paid back total, that's just fine. Then we've got an n to the k, and this, and x to the k. Well, there are exactly k terms up here. So you divide, you take one of these n's and divide into each of these terms. So what you're going to get is a product, right? N over n is 1. N minus 1 over n is 1 minus 1 over n. N minus 2 divided by n is 1 minus 2 over n. All the way down to the last term, n minus k minus 1 over n. And now you can take the limit as n, or sorry, 1 minus. You take the limit as n goes to infinity. This was, right, this is a sum on, sorry, sum of k equals 0 to n. So it becomes the limit k equals 0 to infinity, 1 over k factorial, x to the k, and each of these finite number of factors becomes 1. So the product of those is 1, and that's e to the a. So yeah, if you want to get e to the x, you just have a 1 over n there.
If you want anything else, you've got to put some parameter.
Yeah, well, see, the thing we've been doing is we put some parameter here, some epsilon, times some generator.
Right? Why the very last line?
Here?
Yeah.
That's the power series for e to the x. Right, yeah. Memorize that. Engrave that on your brain. Taylor series for the exponential. Yeah. Derive it. Write down the formula for Taylor series. Just derivatives of the exponential just give exponential back. At zero, it's just one. So you don't get any extra factors other than that Taylor series factorial.
Next question is why do Taylor series work?
Why do Taylor series work? Because you can show that the you have to do a lot of work with limits, convergence, right? You show that the difference between the limit and the nth term decreases, right? I mean, you have to go through some detailed stuff to show that for a function. What you're really doing is coming up with the kth order polynomial approximation to a function, and then you keep adding one, and you show that so you get f to the n of x is like an nth order polynomial that approximates f by using its first n derivative. And what you show is that sequence of fn converges. But you've got to do some work with limits and stuff. You build a few things to
be able to the monotonic and
well, not necessarily, because your function, the 117th derivative might be huge, right? And so until you get past that derivative, it's not going to be a very good approximation.
I guess I'm saying you could probably split it after a certain point from a monotonic and increasing or decreasing, and then bound it. Anything monotonic and bound it.
E to the minus x, the derivatives alternate in sign. There's a counterexample. So you're jumping above and below. It's not a monotonic series at all.
Okay.
Be careful. It's cool stuff. I mean, analysis is really neat. But you've got to think through your proofs here. So there's a proof. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've looked at that one.
How does that very first line work?
A plus B to the N. There's just a formula for it. We could prove it. N chooses a determinatory factor. That symbol means this. Okay, that symbol means that ratio.
Okay.
And then you take A to the K and B to the N minus K. It's symmetric in A and B. It doesn't matter which one goes to which power. K equals 0 to N. So that's a general formula for the nth power of the binomial expansion, right? Okay, so how would you prove it? Tell me how you would prove it. What general proof technique would you use?
Induction.
Right. So if n is 1, you have the sum of two terms. So a plus b to the 1 is supposed to be 1 choose 0, a to the 0, b to the 1 plus 1 choose 1, a to the 1, b to the 0. This is looking good. 1 factorial over 0 factorial times 1 factorial, those are both 1. A to the 0 is 1, b to the 0 is 1, so you get b plus a. And it works. So it works for n equals 1. Now you assume that it holds for n. You multiply in another a plus b and show that you get the same expression at n plus 1. Should we do it? Want to see it?
I think so. Sorry.
So a plus b to the n. So assume that we have this formula, n to the k, a to the k, b to the n minus k, k equals 0 to n. Then it follows that a plus b to the n plus 1 is a plus b times that.
You have to be really careful with that step. So a lot of people just throw it in there.
Okay, so now what is it? Now we have to count. Yeah. So let's see. We're going to have two sums here, right? K equals 0 to n. N factorial, k factorial, n minus k factorial. There's an a to the k plus 1, b to the n minus k. And then we have k equals 0 to n. Same thing here. A to the k, b to the n minus k plus 1. So the thing we've got to do here,
Where did a plus b go?
The a, I put an extra a in
Here,
and the plus 1, there's the extra b. So that's how I get two things. So now, the sum of these things is the right total power. But what we have to do is...
Is it easier to use the fact that a plus b to the first power works over here and just throw in that sum there?
That what?
Well, we already know that a plus b to the one first power
is
this. That's a proven thing. We can actually take that and substitute it in from a plus b and throw it into the sum and it will work out.
How good that is.
Well, just throw it. You can re...
That's just these two terms. But it's the same thing as b plus a.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. but now what you need to do here is change this index. Let's just look at this series. Call that thing A. I want to rename my index L equals 1 to N plus 1. Let's see if that helps. Then we have n factorial over, let's see now, how should I do this? K is L minus 1. And then we have n minus L minus 1 factorial. A to the L minus 1, N, but look, B to the N minus L. Is that right? No, I did something wrong. Oh, it goes up to N plus 1. I'm not sure if I went the right way with it. What we need to do is be able to combine these two theories. And this has gotten the fees the same. So if I just rename K as L, then my A plus B to the N plus 1 is going to be the sum L. So I've got a zero term here. The zero term is N factorial over K equals 0 factorial times N factorial A to the, okay, I'm getting K equals 0. So I have A, and then I have B to the N.
Ooh, I think I'm on this term.
Oh, this has the L equals 0 term here. All right. So now L equals 1 to N, I can take terms from both of these things. So I have N factorial, L factorial, N minus K factorial, plus 1. There's something worrisome about these. Have an extra A squared floating around. That's going to be A squared.
Hang on, I'm missing something here. Let's see, we multiplied A times the first one and B times the second one. So when k
is equal to n, we get the highest power of A, and we get the lowest power of B. But down here, when k is equal to 0, we get the highest power of B and the lowest power of A. So what we'd really like to do is reverse the order of the sum.
Yeah. Okay. Why take that? Yes. Why would we take that? Where would we take it to? And who would we give it to when we got there?
Okay. So, A plus B to the N plus is equal to, and now we did something terribly clever with this. Pull out an A, and that's just the binomial theorem. It's just this thing. Well, these coefficients are totally symmetric in N and N minus K. This is the same as the sum L equals 0 to N, N choose L, A to the N minus L, B to the L. You know, like I say, it's symmetric in A and B. So it doesn't matter whether you sum, which thing you sum first. So I want to change this one to be in that order. Then I think the two series will line up. So we're going to write the first one as the sum L equals 0 to N, N choose L. Then we have A to the N minus L, B to the L, but then that's the one we've multiplied by A, so we have an extra A. So that's the first term in our, the one that's not labeled capital A. Then the one that is labeled capital A, we're writing as the sum L equal 1 to N plus 1, right? Let's see. I hope. N factorial over L minus 1 factorial, and then N minus L minus 1 factorial. Then we have a to the L minus 1, b to the N minus L. Okay. So, how does that look? Yeah.
That doesn't look very good. That looks worse.
Yeah. Homework?
Can we make the first summation go from 1 to n plus 1, like the second summation? Would that help?
Yeah, I'm not sure it would help. I think what I want to do, let's see, when L is n plus 1
over the 4,
now that gives b to the 1. Did I do that renaming right? Is that correct there? Let's see, I want to let k equal L minus 1. Yeah. So then I get L minus 1. That's N minus L. Okay. Then when is it 0? There's b to the n. I don't see what happened to b to the n plus 1. That should be the k equals 0 term, which should be the l equals 1 term. That's not right. Yeah, here, when k equals 0, this is n plus 1. And I'm not seeing that here. So something's amiss. So we want when L is 0, it should be plus. Why isn't that plus? Let me do this again. So I get the high one here. When k equals 0, so when l equals 0, I've got a to the n plus 1. That's good. So I want the l equals 0 end to be high in a and low in b. So over here, I want the big L end to be a high power of b. So I've rewritten this one a indirectly. So I want to change this one too. Then I shouldn't have had to change either of them. And k is when k is n. That's the high end here. When k is n, that becomes a to the n. Yeah, when k is 0, I get b to the n plus 1. When k is n, I get a to the n plus 1. So this is already right. Why am I having trouble? Okay. I need to shift this one by 1. K equals 0 to n, n factorial over k factorial, n minus k factorial. Sorry, I definitely got off track here. K plus 1, b to the n minus k. So let's leave that one alone. But now let's shift this one to an index that runs to n plus 1 from 1. So L equals 1 to n plus 1. So then, let's see. Let's take this one from 1 to n plus 1. Then, let's see, then this is n factorial, then we need k minus 1 factorial, n minus k plus 1, let's call that n plus 1 minus k factorial. And then this is a to the k, and this one is b to the, all right, n minus k minus 1 is n plus 1 minus k. So now I can just add the second series. Now we got it. N factorial, k factorial, n minus k factorial, a to the k, b to the n plus 1 minus k.
So I've gotten the same powers on everything. So
the key is to get a and b to the same powers in both series. And then you throw out what doesn't match. So k equals 0 here, and k equals n plus 1 there, handled separately. And then the intermediate terms you can combine in the two series. So doing that, we have two extra terms. We have the n plus 1 term from the top. That's n factorial over, okay, k is equal to n plus 1 gives us an n factorial in the denominator, and
there's a zero.
N plus 1 right. And a zero factorial, yeah. And then we have a to the n plus 1, period. And then b to the zero. The k equals zero term of the bottom series gives us n factorial, and zero factorial and n factorial. And there we have b to the n plus 1. So those are the n terms. And then we have a sum, k equals 1 to n, the intermediate term, and we get both series. So there's an overall n factorial. Then we have k minus 1 factorial, n plus 1 minus k factorial, plus 1 over k factorial n minus k, and then a to k, b to the n plus 1 minus k. Now, let's digest that mess. There's some common stuff here. Let's write the whole thing. So we've got an n factorial. I'm going to pull out a k minus 1 factorial. And let's see, how does this work? This is n minus quantity k minus 1 factorial. So, and this is smaller. So I can pull out an n minus k factorial. And what I have left is 1 over n minus k minus 1 here. And here I have 1 over k. Now, what is that? That's k plus n minus k plus 1 over k times n minus, now I'll rewrite this as n plus 1 minus k. And the k's go out and I get an n plus 1. So that factor turns this into, right, k equal 1 to n. But then an n plus 1 times that n makes that an n plus 1 factorial. And then an extra k here makes that a k factorial. N minus k times this one makes that one bigger, n plus 1 minus k factorial. A to the k, b to the n plus 1 minus k. And then if I extend this series to 0 and n plus 1, in both of those cases, this becomes 1. This becomes either a to the n plus 1 or b to the n plus 1. And I have exactly those two terms here. So this is the same as k equals 0 to n plus 1. N plus 1 choose k, a to the k, b to the n plus 1 minus k. And we've got it. So we prove the binomial formula.
But I think what we did today is right. We'll get it.
So then the problem is, you know, that different equation we wrote, what is the solution? Is it still vessel or?
I don't know.
So we wanted to try that and see.
I have a question on this last week's conception.
Yes.
Remember factorial of n minus k is k plus 1.
Here you go.
So it took out everything.
All right. Yeah.
Try that.
A is the 1 point.
Right.
So, when we take D of A, we get dA times D,
right.
But D is passing a 1 point to get minus dB.
Oh, okay.
So you get that product for A is the 1 point.
That's okay. Yeah.
Move D to the front, then you get dBA plus dBA, and then interchange them. You're interchanging two 1 points, then you get that.
So the data that goes into this still, the way I was thinking about this is, I was doing it a little bit different. I was doing it like this, you know. But you can't just have A, B, B plus C, A, and B. The derivative doesn't look like that. That's very really
stupid. No. Yeah. Look. So the question here is about the, When you take D of AV, right, A is a one form here. So there are a couple ways you can think of this, but let's write it all out. This is dx alpha, dx alpha, wedged with A beta dx beta times a function V. All right, so you can take the derivative. So you're going to get d alpha a beta dx beta times d plus a beta dx beta d alpha v. So there's your usual product rule. But now bring this dx alpha where it needs to be. Well, on the first term, you want it right there, dx alpha wedge dx beta. And you've got a v along for the ride. That's just dA. But here, you want to move that dx past this dx beta. So you're going to get minus, that's A there. And then dx alpha d alpha z. So we've interchanged two one forms here. So you get a minus sign. So this is minus a which d of z. So we get dA times d minus a times which dB. Right. And in general, what we found is d of a p-form wedge with a q-form was this one of your exercises? You're going to get d of omega wedge eta. That one will always work for
right.
Right. But then you get a minus 1 to the t, because this d has to move past p one form, omega wedge d eta.
Yeah, that's right. Oh,
yeah,
I remember that.
Okay.
So, yeah,
well,
I probably had your crew
to
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
now
we'll fly it. Okay. Are there other questions? Maybe there are lots of other questions.
Did you figure out that gamma that I was asking about last
time?
What was the question? Gamma matrix.
Is that
the dagger of the gamma matrix is equal to plus or minus?
Well, let's see. No, not beyond what we did. The Lorentz transformation, I mean, the sigma AB, the commutator, shows that if one's Hermitian, the other has to be anti-Hermitian. Right, in order to ever get boost, the generators have to be symmetric. So, have to be Hermitian. So, a rotation, the generators are anti-Hermitian, boost, the generators are Hermitian. And you only get that if some of the gamuts are different than others. Beyond that, you actually can choose. There are some explicit constructions for gamma matrices in two to the n dimensions. Are in fact explicitly Hermitian or anti-Hermitian that have those properties. So that proves that you can do it. And then the commutator shows that you have to. They have to be opposite. But I think it's easy to choose them. Choose the one set Hermitian, the other set anti-Hermitian, and either way will work. Other questions?
These alphas actually have some variable dependency.
These are gauge fields. These are fields over some manifold. And in the construction we're actually in the middle of, we're going to construct that manifold at the same time that we construct the gauge field. So then let's go back to where we were last time. We had just written down, we had four translations together with a U1 symmetry. Totally abelian group. That's going to make everything really easy. But let's carry through. We got our proof is a binomial. Expansion.
Yeah, we proved it.
So our big group is a four-dimensional translation group, direct product with U1. And let's say what do we call the elements of this? And we had two parameters. There was a vector, a constant space-time vector, A beta, and there was an angle, phi. So that's a generic element where G of A beta and phi is a pair. Now let's see. see, what do I want to call? So we call our translation element T, maybe. And it, that depended on that the vector of translation. And then, this was this matrix, right? So each of these is a pair where one of these things is a matrix where we have the identity here and a 1 there and the vector A beta here, 0 is there. And the second element is e to the I phi. And the way that that acts on a pair, right, that acts on pairs where the first element is some vector V capital A and the second element is some field, where VA is equal to X alpha and 1. So that's a 5-dimensional vector. And the effect of this is to act with 1 and A beta and 1 on X beta and 1. That's the first element of the pair. And then the second element is to multiply the field by e to the I phi. So that's what one of these elements does to one of those vectors and one of those functions. Okay, so there's a group. We want to take, the next thing we want to do is find the Maurer-Hartmann equation. So we have generators, there ought to be 4 of these, so G alpha, and we know that they all commute. And then the U1 has a single generator, what should we call it? About G0. There's only 1 and it commutes with itself. And since we're taking a direct product, you can easily see from this rule that doing one of these commutes with doing one of those. We could do something that was the identity here and a transformation there, or something that's the identity here and a transformation there. We could do those in either order and we'd get the same thing.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So the generators have the translation. In matrix form, we represent that as a 1 on one of these corners, on the top right corners.
Yeah. So let's look at what the G alphas are. Right. We're going to look at infinitesimal transformations. So the A has become epsilon. Right. And so we're going to write that as the identity plus some linear combination of the generators, and the combination is clear. So, for example, G1 is going to be like that first component. So it's zeros here, and we get a 1 there, et cetera.
Right, okay.
Yeah, your sense of that is just right. Did you have a flaky day today?
I feel flaky today.
Is it rainy there?
The rain is the rain.
It was a tough day. I'm naturally very scatterbrained now.
I'm not feeling particularly focused either. But anyway, was there a question?
I'm still like an hour behind.
It's Wednesday.
Did that help? You know, it often helps.
Let me ask you a quick question that is off topic.
Sure, what you got?
Is this where we're allowed to take the limit inside of here? And all of these things go to one? Or is there an issue of precedent?
Oh, yeah, I have to take that into infinity as well. The upper limit of the song.
So all one has to do is turn that into infinity.
Put infinity for every N, and the thing makes sense.
But there's no issue of precedence. I could either do that, which we just said, or the other one first.
You want to do them all at once. You pretty much need to do them all at once. But you can. There are a finite number of terms. In any term in this song, you have a finite number of terms.
Okay.
So you can do them all at once.
Okay, sorry.
Let's
try and leave this behind and get the real stuff here.
Okay. Let me call this one G5. Otherwise, I can call that one G0. So 0, 1, 2, 3 here correspond to the space-time direction, that's all. So G2, we have 0s, and 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0s everywhere else, and so on. So we have one generator with a 1 in each of those first four positions. And then this linear combination gives you the general infinitesimal transformation. And you can multiply those together all you want. You'll just get zeros. So the commutators definitely are going to vanish. So you check that. And for G5, e to the I 5, but now we're going to let phi be an epsilon. You just expand the exponential like this, and G5, so, you know, basically G5 is 1. It needs to be anything. The 1-by-1 identity matrix would be fine for that. Or I times it. You could stick the I in there if you want. But that's all you get for that one. So there's only the one generator, and you're done. We're going to drop that, and this has got to be equal to 1 plus epsilon times G5. So G5 is just the number I. There. Don't do it that way. And I commutes with itself.
I sense I have to
want it. Yeah. This time, I sense I'll be 1. Yeah. Give or take, it's fine. Okay. So,
this time are invisible.
So this is the Lie algebra. Does anyone have any doubt that the Jacobi identity holds? So we check the Jacobi identity. It holds because everything is 0.
Right.
So
anytime you consider anything 0, it's
not fine. So all of the structure constants are 0. So what is the Maurer-Cartan equation?
0.
Well, we have 0 for the structure constants.
So Maurer-Cartan.
The D of
anything equals 0. Yeah.
We have. We define dual one form, so we have some omega alphas to go with the G betas. And we have let's call it a one form A to go with G5. And that needs to be delta. And that needs to be 1. There's only 1 there. And then we have D of the omega alphas minus a half structure constant,
which are 0,
and alpha, yeah. And the A, more like 0. So Easy structure equation. Okay, so now we want to do two things here. We want to take the quotient and I want to take the quotient by U1. That gives me a four-dimensional manifold and a U1 connection on it. Now, that means that I'm going to expand the basis form here in terms of the cells, and A, I'm going to expand in terms of just the horizontal forms. Since moving up and down in the A direction, changing phi, we don't want that to affect anything. That's just a gauge transformation, so that doesn't affect the physics. We don't want to put an independent, like a d phi, out here. In general, we would have, you know, plus lambda d phi and plus delta d phi or something, if we were just expanding on the whole five-dimensional space. But we're not. We're restricting to the submanifold. And now we add horizontal curvature. And that gives us the Cartan structure equation. So we get d of omega alpha is some 2-form T alpha, and D of A is going to be some 2-form we'll call F, where these have to be horizontal, so T alpha is expandable to T alpha mu nu omega mu wedge omega nu, and A is expandable as A, oh sorry, F is horizontal, means F can be expanded the same way, omega mu wedge omega nu. Now, at this point, we need the Bianchi identities. Which means just the integrability condition. We need d of omega alpha, d squared of omega alpha is d of t alpha has to be zero. So T has to be D of something, and D squared of A is identically zero, so DF has to vanish. So F has to be D of something. Well, it is. It's D of A. So these conditions are going to be fine. T alpha is called the torsion. It's the same torsion we met in general relativity. It's the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel connection. And in general relativity, it's taken to be zero. I think we talked about this a little bit last term. It's if it's not zero, then your covariant derivative doesn't commute when acting on a function, and that gets very weird. You lose integrability of functions around the manifold, and it's a sort of funky thing to deal with. People do. People sometimes talk about Dirichlet torsion, but
we're going to set T alpha equals 0. We could actually write some field equations for T and solve them. T alpha equals 0 would probably be a solution to those equations for almost any sensible equations we would write. But let's just start off with T equals 0. And now, now we can't go much anywhere further until we write down some equations of motion or some field equations we put in the physics. Right? This is where the physics comes in.
This is where we introduce the action then?
Yeah. We want to write an action. And T alpha if we want to include torsion, but let's keep it simple for now. So we want to write an action for F. It needs to be invariant. It needs to be a four-dimensional integral. Generally, I mean there are other ways to make actions besides integrals, but how can we build a four form out of F? What's the Hodge dual of F?
Hodge dual of F. Well, F is an extra.
It interchanges some of the parts.
Well, okay, we'll get another two forms, right?
Yeah, we get another two forms.
Right.
We're going to wipe them together. So there are two things. There are two things we can do. We can take F wedge F, or we can take F wedge the dual of F. Those are about the only four forms you can write. I mean, you could take like the dual of that and multiply it by that or something. You could get higher order stuff, but the only quadratic things you can write, only things second order in F are those. There's nothing you can write that's linear without introducing some other forms. So this is pretty much what you're limited to. We could also remember we had some other fields. We might ask for some fields that depend on VA or on function psi. Well, I can't. Let's see. VA is really just the coordinate. So we're talking about a field theory, not some dynamical point particles. But we could stick in a psi. How can we build something from psi that is what's it going to be? It has to be invariant under the group. And it needs to be a four form. Well, we'd like to, let's see, what would we like to do? Let's take something like the Dirac action. I mean, that's where we might have gotten it. So, what we want is probably something like psi bar I d slash minus m psi. That's the Dirac action that we might well have started with, but now we need to make that a covariant derivative here. And then we can just integrate over the whole manifold. We can say, well, you know, take a volume form. So let's let S of psi be psi star I covariant derivative slash minus M psi times capital omega, where capital omega is just epsilon alpha beta mu nu, omega alpha wedge omega beta wedge omega mu wedge omega nu. There we go. There's a four form.
So just take the volume form on the manifold, right? An epsilon with saturated with basis forms is a volume form. So now we've got a theory. We add those two actions together.
Would it make any sense to for the upper action for S, where you have A, F, F, Y, F? Would it make any sense to do like Y to two with duals together? Or is that ending linear?
Oh, S star with F star. Oh, sure.
Right.
It's the same as that.
Okay.
Those turn out to be the same thing.
Okay.
But we can certainly write it down and ask, well, you know, oh, look, it's the same thing. So let's check it.
Okay.
Yeah, we want to be general, so we write all three.
Okay.
In fact, both of them are total divergences and don't give anything. The variations, the curvature is always a covariant derivative. And the Bianchi identity is always the vanishing of a covariant derivative. And so what happens is that if you take curvature, which curvature is your action, its variation is always a total divergence and doesn't give you anything. It's quite a general result. Okay, you good here?
Yeah.
All right, so let's see what all this says.
Which two did you say end up being the same?
We added a third one here. F star with F star.
Is the same.
That turns out to be the same as F plus F.
Okay.
And they both turn out to be total divergences.
Okay.
But we'll show that. We'll show it. So, let's look at star F wedge star F. All right. That is 2. Let's see. If we let F equal a half F alpha beta omega alpha wedge omega beta, then we have a half F alpha beta F1 alpha beta mu nu omega mu wedge omega nu. That's one F dual, and we need to put together a pair of those. F rho sigma epsilon rho sigma gamma delta omega gamma omega wedge omega delta. So, what happens here? Let me write this as a quarter. Let me put this as F alpha beta up. Epsilon alpha beta mu nu. And then this one I want to write as F rho sigma g gamma lambda g delta tau epsilon rho sigma gamma delta omega mu nu lambda tau. Now let's see. Those should have been Levi-Civitas tensors, really.
Right.
It's a flat space. Yeah, it's a flat space, so make them epsilon.
So
we'll use Cartesian coordinates. Actually, we do have Cartesian coordinates because t equals zero means we can solve this equation and write omega as the x alpha. So it really is a flat space. Well, I was going to look at that later. I'll come back to that.
And also, if you have translations that aren't in a flat space, they necessarily commute.
No, they won't commute. Right. Yeah, if you don't have translations in a non-flat space, because it's not symmetric. I mean, you might have a sphere. You might have some symmetry that translates you around the space. But
it's a very special space if you do. So let's just go with the epsilons here. And let's see, the problem is we've got way too many of them. let's see, what if we let... let omega be our volume form, and let's define it as epsilon alpha beta mu nu, omega alpha omega beta omega mu omega nu. Then omega alpha omega beta wedge omega mu wedge omega nu can be written as an epsilon alpha beta mu nu times the volume form times some factor. And the factor is going to be minus 1 over 4 factorial. Because if I slap another epsilon on this, I put an epsilon alpha beta mu nu on both sides, this side gives me omega, and this side gives me that minus 1 over 4 factorial times 2 epsilon times omega, and all of that is 1. So that's the right coefficient. Remember, there's a minus sign when we erase all four of those in space-time. So if I do that, then I can write this with 3 epsilon. So I can write star F wedge star F is a quarter F alpha beta F rho sigma G gamma lambda G delta tau epsilon alpha beta mu nu down alpha beta mu nu. Then we have an epsilon rho sigma gamma delta up. And we have an epsilon mu nu lambda tau up, and minus 1 over 4 factorial times our volume form. So I can extract a volume form, or an epsilon from that stuff. And now, this one's not too bad. That's going to be delta lambda mu delta tau mu minus delta lambda nu delta tau mu times some factor. I think the factor is minus 2, but let's check. If I sum lambda mu and tau nu, I've got to get minus 4 factorial. What I get is 4 here times 4 here is 16, and now I'm summing across, so I have to subtract the trace of 1 delta at 4. 16 minus 4 is 12, times minus 2 is minus 4 factorial. So minus 2 is the right prefactor here. So those two epsilon give me those Kronekers. And I have minus 1 over 4 times 4 factorial, calling the choice of normalization. F alpha beta, yeah, I should have defined omega with a... I should have put a 1 over 4 factorial here. Let's see, F rho sigma, G, let's see, then there's a minus 2, so this becomes 2 plus 2. Let me use this on these G's. So I'm going to have a G gamma lambda becomes mu, so gamma mu, G delta tau becomes nu, minus the same thing with mu and nu interchange, gamma nu g delta mu. And then we have an epsilon, what's left, rho sigma lambda delta, and our volume form omega. Everybody with me? Anybody with me?
Should look over my shoulder once in a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so now, let's see, what are we going to do with this? Okay, the gamma delta, wait a minute, there should be a lambda delta, what did I do? Lambda, wait a minute, what? Oh, I used those two.
Right.
That's gamma delta, again, oh, I used gamma delta here.
Right. Oh.
It's a gamma, right.
Yeah. Okay, so these two are just lower those last two indices. That's right. These two just lower the last two indices. Notice gamma delta here, gamma delta here. The only difference between these, you can think of it as a gamma delta interchange. So both of them give the same thing on that anti-symmetric epsilon. I just get a factor of two. So star F wedge star F is going to be... what I'm saying is each of these on that epsilon, it just lowers gamma and delta. So I get rho sigma sub mu nu minus rho sigma sub nu mu, but if I flip those, it changes the minus to a plus. So I just get 2, which gives me a 2 up there, which cancels the 4. So 1 over 4 factorial. Then F alpha beta F rho sigma. And then I have an epsilon rho sigma.
What happened to alpha beta?
Oh, I used the wrong one. These should have been, the mu and nu should have been alpha and beta. I'm sorry. You all saw that, didn't you? You were just waiting for me.
I totally missed that. But I get it. Like, now that I see it and looking back and forth, I'm noticing it.
Okay. I'm combining these two bracketed ones. Notice they're summed on mu and nu. The free indices are a lambda tau up and an alpha beta down. I took the wrong pair. So they're going to give a pair of Kronecker's, but I labeled the pair wrong. So here it's going to replace the lambda tau, get replaced by alpha and beta on these metrics. And so now the metrics lower this to give an alpha beta, which is much better. And then we have a capital omega, if you can see that. Then let's raise those and lower these, and we have 1 over 4 factorial F alpha beta F rho sigma F, whoops, rho sigma up. Epsilon, I can interchange a pair, alpha, beta, rho, sigma, and my volume is 1. So that's star F wedge star. That's a terrible F. Yeah. Okay, so we got an expression for that. Now let's look at F wedge F. Alright, that's a quarter F mu nu, F alpha beta, omega mu wedge omega nu wedge omega alpha wedge omega beta. And by our definition of capital omega, that's minus 1 over 4 times 4 factorial F mu nu F alpha beta. Epsilon mu nu alpha beta times capital omega. Same thing. Just lower those indices, raise these. Different coefficient out front, but we've got arbitrary constants there anyway. So I can raise these if I lower those. And I have the volume form here, and those are the same thing, up to an overall constant. So we can lump the first and third terms in the action together.
So.
One question.
Yeah.
So we lowered the indices on the epsilon,
okay? Uh-huh.
And you raised the indices on the epsilon.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So can we do that because are you using metrics to do that? Or?
Yeah. Use a pair of metrics. So if I've got Z mu W mu, I can write this as Z mu G mu alpha G alpha nu W nu, and that gives me Z mu Kronecker mu nu W nu, which is Z mu W mu.
So we're using the Euclidean metrics.
I've pulled the metric out of the air, right? It would be actually we're in Minkowski space here. I'm thinking Minkowski space. So it's eta. It's just a Minkowski metric.
So this is driven by okay. So we can get a minus sign when we lower the epsilon.
Okay, four metrics on an epsilon up is an epsilon down. Numerically, there's a minus sign in there relative to what it had been before, but the minus sign is built into the difference between those symbols.
Okay.
No,
is there a minus sign? Because you got four, you do it four times.
Yeah, and one of the times was a minus one because of the metric being Minkowski. So you have. Yeah, the Minkowski metric, lowering any spatial index just gives the same thing, but lowering the time index, you get a minus one.
Right, but using four metrics, so the four metrics minus one would all cancel.
Yeah, but all four of those are always different.
Oh, got it. Okay, there we go.
Okay, so let's collect what we've got. I tow the erasers. They're all huddling over here now. Let's see, we have these structure equations, the Cartan structure equations. You good here?
Yes.
Cartan structure equations and an action. So, here's what we've got. We have Cartan structure equations. T omega alpha equals zero, because we're taking T alpha equals zero. dA equals F. And we have the action, which tells us that S is some field. I covariant D slash minus M psi. Times some volume form plus, let's just take it as A F wedge F plus B F star F. F wedge star F. Okay. So, let's see. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to work out what these are. How do you want to do this? Yeah, okay. Let me write out this one. F wedge star F. This one we can leave in this form. Varying that will be easy in that form. This one becomes, right, we've got a half F mu nu, dx mu wedge dx nu, or sorry, omega mu wedge omega nu. And we wedge that with the dual of an f. So we have a half
we're going to have 1 over 2 factorial. We have an F. I'll raise the indices on that. Alpha, beta, epsilon, alpha, beta, rho, sigma, dx, rho, wedge, dx, sigma. So we have 1/8 F mu nu, F alpha, beta. Then we have an epsilon, alpha, beta, rho, sigma. And then we have, I keep writing these dx's, these are omega, rho, wedge, omega, sigma. I'm going to use the volume form again. So we have minus 1 over 4 factorial epsilon mu nu rho sigma times the volume form capital omega. And now I want to combine those two epsilons. It's the same thing as we had back here. There's no rho minus 2. So we're going to get 1 over 4 times 4 factorial, canceling the minus 2. We have F mu nu, F alpha beta. I've gotten the minus 2. So now we have Kronecker, and we're summing rho sigma. So we're going to have mu alpha, mu beta, minus Kronecker, mu beta, mu alpha. And our volume form, capital omega. Right, on an F, this gives an F mu nu. This gives minus F nu mu. Those are the same because F is anti-symmetric. It's a 2 form. So I just get F mu nu times a factor of 2. So we have 1/2 times 4 factorial F mu nu F mu nu omega. Notice that's the Maxwell action. We've seen that before.
Oh, yeah.
So now we vary F. With respect to Phi bar, we're going to get I d slash minus m acting on psi equals 0. Right. Just vary that. And all that's left is this. The volume form doesn't do anything. That function has to vanish. The volume form is non-zero. So the vanishing has to be due to that equation. Varying psi implies the conjugate equation. If we vary with respect to the potential, the gauge field, right, this is the other variation we do, then we're going to get 3 things. Right? Remember this covariant derivative acting on psi is an exterior derivative of psi plus a psi. So there's an a inside that. So when I vary a, I'll have a term phi bar gamma alpha times the variation of A alpha. A slash. Yeah. C slash is a different thing than D. This is a one form. This D slash is a gamma alpha d alpha. Okay, where I've pulled off the basis form. So that's what I'm writing here. So I've pulled off the dx here. And then we have psi times the volume form. Then we have 2A, well, let me do it out. We have A times, remember that F is dA. So since F is dA, when I vary A, I get D of del A. So I'm going to have a term D of del A with F, and I'm going to have a term F wedge D of del A when I vary the F wedge F term. And then varying this, let's use this form for it. So I have 1 over 96 times, okay, varying this, remember that F is dA, that means F is the curl of A, right, the four-dimensional curl. So both of these give the same factor, so I get a factor of 2, and then I get another factor of 2 because I have d mu A nu minus d mu A mu. So I'm going to end up with 4 times F mu nu d mu del A nu. I can write it that way. Everything in sight, let's not do it that way. That's got a volume form. This one's got a volume form. That one still is a volume form. Now, integrate by parts. So note that D of del A wedge F, right? So these two terms are the same, right? This is just 2A times the same thing. Because F is a 2 form, I can move the 1 form past it. So I just have two things that look like this. So I can write that as D of del A wedge F, and then remember A is a 1 form, so I'm going to pick up a sign, and then I'll have del A wedge DF. Notice anything about that? What's the Bianchi identity?
Oh.
Okay.
Yes
equals 0. So that term goes away, and I can just pull the D out. So this term, the integral of 2a d del a wedge f is the same as the integral of d of 2a del a wedge f is a surface term, which goes to 0. Goes to 0 because our variation vanishes on the boundary. Okay, so we integrate the total derivative. We integrate to the surface of our region where we're varying is. We hold a fix on that boundary, so del A is 0 there. So the whole integral over that boundary of that quantity is 0. So that term does nothing.
On this third line, is that 1 over, what did I say, 1 over?
96, that's 4 times 4 factorial.
Oh, okay.
I multiplied that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it could also be QB, but that wouldn't make any sense. Okay, everybody with me? Questions? We're just sort of cruising along here. How about it, Joe? Got one for us? What would you like to see?
I want to see the integration by parts again.
Okay, you get this line? Let's see, I'm taking D of a 1 form wedge with 2 form. So I get D of the first term wedge the second. And then
plus minus 1 to the p, where p is the order of that form, so a minus 1, times del A times d of the second one. Okay, so it's just the product rule, but there's a sign because that del A is a 1 form.
Okay.
And then df is 0 by the Bianchi identity because of the particular form of f. So that means that I can replace, right here I have d of del A wedge f, that's this. But I can replace that by a derivative of the whole thing. So I can move this d outside of all of this for free. And 2a is a constant, I can even move it outside of 2a if I want. So this is the integral of d of something. Now we use the generalized Stokes theorem to say the integral of d of something is the integral of the thing over the boundary. And but this thing del A vanishes on the boundary by definition. We've chosen it that way. So this is equal to, if this is over some four-dimensional volume, then that's the same as 2a del A wedge f over the three-dimensional boundary of that volume, and that's a closed integral over that boundary. Probably some three-dimensional thing, you know, two spatial derivatives in time, you know, could be any three volume in space-time. But we don't vary on the boundary. We only vary inside the volume. So del A is, by our definition of del A, we chose what we were going to vary. We choose something that we don't vary on the boundary of our region. So the integrand of that integral is zero everywhere. Everywhere on that boundary. Does that help?
I think so.
Good. Other questions?
What did we get to turn on this last one? With the
with the which one?
The variation of
here?
Or higher up. Right there.
Here.
We have two terms in the previous slide, but we only have one term.
We got a factor of 4. Alright. What I'm varying is I've got f mu nu, and I want to vary A in that expression. Think of this as del f mu nu plus f mu nu del f mu nu. That gives me two of the same thing because I can just flip the indices. And now this is d mu del A mu minus d mu del A mu. And because this is anti-symmetric, those are the same thing. So I get 4 f mu nu times d mu of del A mu. And that 4 is the one right here.
The tree cut definition of f is d mu A mu. Is that right?
F and CA.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just take the components of that.
I got it.
Okay. What else should I do? lots of details here. You get factors a little bit, right? Okay.
So this is going to sound remedial. Notation, the delta A, delta sub A, F.
That's just to remind me, the action depends on two different fields, three, psi bar and A. Those are the independent things that you're going to vary. So I'm just indicating which variation I'm doing. I got this by varying psi bar, so, you know, I would call that del psi bar of F, just as a mnemonic to tell me what I'm varying.
Okay. But then it kept showing up throughout.
That's del sub A of F. This is the actual variation here. I'm varying the field. So these del A's are the variation of the field.
My big question is, where do you get the first part? First part you added, the first function you added with the differential forms of f.
Yeah, this I'm varying del psi, so I come in psi bar, so I just get that. That has to be, that's the only psi bar in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when I vary psi bar, you know, that's the answer. That has to be zero. The only way that can be zero is if that thing in the middle goes to zero. So that's what gives me this.
Oh, okay.
Right,
okay.
And then if I vary psi, well, now I've got to integrate by parts. But we showed before that you get the conjugate equation from that.
Okay.
We did that all out the other day.
Sure, that was... That's the
So, let's come back to this end. And see what we've got left after all of that. That was a whole bunch of different things going on. So, the variation of S with respect to A, we're going to demand is zero. And that has reduced to two terms. We have I psi bar gamma alpha psi delta alpha omega from the first term in the action. The second term in the action gives nothing. That goes away. Then we have b over 4 factorial. I can pull that out of the integral if we like. Then 4 over 96 is 24. That's 4 factorial. F mu nu d mu a del a nu times an omega. And I want to integrate that by parts. All right, this I write as d mu of f mu nu del a nu minus d mu of f mu nu times del a nu. This is a total derivative. That's a boundary term again. And so this goes to an integral over sigma of f mu nu del a nu normal to the region d3 sigma, and del a is zero there. So it's the same argument that we did down here. So we just get this term. So we have zero is equal to I phi bar gamma alpha phi. And now, let's see, I want to change the index on this del alpha, del a nu to an alpha. We have minus d over 4 factorial d mu f mu alpha, I'll call it, del a alpha omega. Now, we've separated out the del A, the variation of the field A. So the coefficient, the thing in brackets, has to be zero. And what we find is that the divergence of F mu alpha has to be equal to some constant, 4 factorial over B, times I psi bar gamma alpha psi. Define E to be 4 factorial over B, and we have the Maxwell equation with the electric charge of the electron and the electron field giving the source.
And we have the Dirac equation for that electron field, which tells this has an A in it, so this tells how psi is coupled to the electromagnetic potential. So that capital D over here contains capital A, and so psi is going to respond to the presence of electric potentials. And then this is the Maxwell, these are the two Maxwell equations that have a source. We worked through that. That's divergence of the electric field is the charge density. That would be the zero component of this combination. And in fact, you can see that directly. Let's look at that a second. If alpha equals zero, what we have is d mu of f mu zero. Right? That is, we know the divergence of the electric field is equal to I e phi bar gamma zero phi. But phi bar is phi conjugate times gamma zero. That's how we define that bar. And gamma zero is minus the identity. So the divergence of the electric field is IE times, I guess there's a minus sign here, we just get phi star phi. That we've seen, I guess I showed it in quantum. That's the probability density for where the electron is. So the electric charge is distributed exactly the same way the electron is. The probability of measuring the electron, you know, times the charge is exactly the source. I'm not sure why there's an I there. That's probably a wrong convention, right? That I came from the IV slash. Oh, wait a minute. Our generator had an I in it. That's the problem. Where did I put it in? Here. Our generator was an I. And so, that's going to give us a, let's see, what did I give us, a minus sign?
What do you have to make to actualize?
Let's see, where? This is, there's a minus sign here. Yeah, there should have been another minus there, so that becomes minus. And so instead of that, we have minus. And that's right. No I, just a minus one. So it's a negatively charged current. Phi star phi is positive, and our electron current moves just the same. That's the probability density for where we define phi. So E times it is the probability density for where we find charge. Then the current equation, all right, the spatial components of this, let's look at those. Let's see, what is it we have? D mu F mu I. Okay, there's going to be a ddt of the electric field, or a minus dEdt plus the curl of B, is that right? Or is it plus? Okay, which one's the plus? Yeah, this is the source one, so I think it's plus here. It's going to be minus E phi bar gamma I psi. And this was what we identified as the current density. There's this conserved current. In fact, you know, here's another connection. Yet another connection. The original
global U1 symmetry of the Dirac action. Another theorem applies. That's a continuous symmetry, so from it we can find a conserved current. This is the conserved current that we find. This, exactly this psi bar gamma alpha psi is the conserved current from the original global U1 symmetry. And it now provides the source for our Maxwell field. Which is really cool.
That is cool. Can you say that again, please?
Sure. The original U1 symmetry, global U1 symmetry of the action, has an associated conserved nether current. Right? You can use any symmetry of an action to derive a conserved quantity. So the Dirac equation is going to have some current that is conserved as a result of the global U1 symmetry we started with. Right, that's exactly this psi bar gamma alpha psi. That's what you find for that nether current. So we already knew that this was a conserved current. It follows from the equation too. If I take d sub alpha of that, the left side vanishes. So d sub alpha of the thing on the right has to be zero, and it is by virtue of the Dirac equation. So, suddenly, all this physics comes pouring out. So we're gonna keep doing more of this, right? This was the very simplest abelian symmetry we could dream of. We'll do this for SU2, SU3, Poincaré group, all of them together, conformal group, we'll look at a whole bunch of different gate theories. Yeah, Nathan.
I have a few questions, actually.
Yeah, fine. Let's look.
Just on the mythology. So you convert you start with the group, start with the subgroup quotient, figure out the Cartan equation from that.
Right.
The problem I have is when you get to the action, is where what's the rationale to get the action not formed, basically.
Okay.
Since I might take the variance
I should have solved these back here. I guess d of omega alpha equals zero implies omega is d of some functions. You take those functions to be the coordinates on the manifold. So we solved that equation. Now solving this one, okay, this is the other two Maxwell equations. All right, those are the homogeneous Maxwell equations. All right, df equals zero is, curl of b is zero, and curl of E minus dB dt.
So A is potential in this case then?
What's that? A is the potential.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought A was
gauge field.
Yeah.
Gauge field with
the
vector potential. Yeah, right. Same thing. Yeah. Yeah. The names have been changed to confuse the innocent. Let's see. How do we get the action? For AMP, we wrote the most general second order action possible. We found that one term did absolutely nothing. Another term was the same as the one that did nothing. And the third gave us the Maxwell action. So, what we got is the most general second order differential equation we could have gotten from that two-form, F. So, okay. Let me back up. What fields do we have? We set this one to zero, so the only tensor field around is F. So we write the most general thing we can involving this two-form. We need a four-form, so we wedge it with itself and its dual. So we built the simplest possible things we could from that. It's actually fairly... you can build higher order things, and they're then you would really wonder how they were motivated. Like, you know, I mean, you can write an infinite number of actions with a given field, but the only simple things you can write, we wrote. The only second order things you can write, we wrote. So, a great deal of generality to how we constructed the part of this action that depends on S. We have the full action up here, I guess not. Oh, here, yeah. So, these terms, fully general. This term, actually, from the physics point of view, this is what you start with. From our point of view, this is something built from that field that our group acted on. From the vector, well, spinner field that our group acted on. Remember our original T4 cross U1. The T4 acted on some vectors, but the U1 acted on some field, some presumably spinner field. The equation for that field needs only be invariant under our original symmetry group. Well, this is. We can do a translation. It doesn't affect this four-dimensional integral. And we can change phi by a global phase, and it doesn't affect that. So this action is invariant under that original global G symmetry. And by gauging it, we've found the covariant derivative that makes it local. So this might not be a bad starting point for the whole argument. You write down some particle action, where particle means particle of matter rather than particle of force. What gauging does is give you forces. So you write down your matter field, in this case, the psi for an electron. And now you notice that you have some symmetry, and you gauge that symmetry. When we follow this fuller procedure, where we start with the group and the Maurer-Cartan equations, we generalize the Maurer-Cartan equations, we're actually also constructing the manifold on which these things live. So we probably wouldn't have written down this action before we knew what that manifold was. So in that case, what you would probably do is to say, okay, what representation of the group do I have? Well, we had a representation that acted on some field by multiplying it by a phase. So at the point where we've constructed our manifold, we solve for our coordinates, we know what the manifold is, now we know what the volume form on that manifold looks like, and at that point we can write a phase invariant action for that representation. So you need to step back a little bit further on your matter fields as well. Your matter fields will be representations of your group. So if you know what group you want, you can say, well, okay, what vector space does that group act on? That gives me a representation of the group. Okay, so now when I get to a manifold, I can say, oh, now I had these vector representations of my group. I can write an equation for this, I can write a piece of my action that talks about how such vectors propagate. And then I can write anything that makes reasonable physical sense. There are only two things that make reasonable physical sense, the Dirac equation and the Klein-Gordon equation. So, you know, it's either first or second derivative fields. Higher order fields are actually hard to do consistently. You run into constraints. Not forbidden, but they can be tricky with
derivative coupling. Some the Gang-Mills theories we'll write do have some derivative terms. Let me think, what's it look like? Yeah, you end up having derivative terms in the electroweak and the strong action. Right, that A with A term in the field strength. When you vary A there, you're going to get some derivatives of the other A. You know, they don't all look like F. You know, some of them just look like derivatives of A. And you have to worry about what they do. But they do the right thing. But, you know, they do add some additional derivative terms to the way the particles interact with one another. Yeah, we'll see that as we write out plane FU2 theory. We'll look at that.
Put it all in this lesson, FU2 and FU3.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we've done U1 here. Yeah, might as well do the whole shebang. No, not even spring break yet. We could try E8. Could you bring in a representation of the group?
Okay, sure.
And we'll have a look. let's see. Actually, I'd like to do G2. G2's only got 14 generators. I'd like to look at G2. So if you can find the Lie algebra of G2, bring it in and we'll gauge G2. I'm really curious about that one. There's a conformal gauge theory I've been working with that leads to almost a G2 symmetry. The quotient of G2 by dilatation. In fact, it's a certain quotient by dilatation. So it's probably a 13 parameter quotient. Let's see. Yeah, I don't know what that's going to be. Yeah, at least some symmetry. Yeah, it could be a nice left-right symmetric electroweak theory. That seems... Yeah, it certainly is at least that big. An SU2 cross SU2. It'd be nice to see an SU3 in it, though. But don't know. More questions? Can I go home?
I'm going to maybe they start going to.
Yeah, okay. I'll flesh out any of this if you have questions.
I think I need to look at it before I've got to tell her some questions.
Okay.
I
can't hear because there's a rolling thing out here. What you say?
I would have seen this before. How does this grow and
oh, yeah.
To make sense,
yeah. We show that current, you know, rho and j is conserved. There's a continuity equation for that. You know, the usual continuity equation. And it follows from the Dirac equation.
Is that all left term to current?
Yeah.
Do you actually have to have the action before you come up with the conservation law? Is that part of
the Yeah, you really get it from the action. You want to have the action before you get that. Let me see. Yeah, we could dedicate Friday to any sorts of questions if you guys want to, you know, pour over this. I wouldn't mind leaving a little early this Friday.
I don't touch it anyway.
Oh, okay. So, I don't know.
You want to just do that then? The questions?
Yeah.
And maybe try to leave early on Friday?
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. So, yeah, look over the stuff, come in with as many questions as you can read up and look at them, but, you know, maybe we'll leave it at that Friday. But I'm off.
do it.
Okay. Good.
That's amazing that that's the simplest case.
Oh, well, it did get going here, didn't it? Yeah. Well, you know.